Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist, and it is fantastic to have you all here with us for this very special episode dealing with the Golden Dome, the Philadelphia experiment, and the UFO file. And these things link up rather dramatically, actually, when we put them together, as we're going to tonight in this very special overview dealing with this. Now, I want to say that this gets into a lot of the deep histories and the deep past surrounding President Trump. Trump's uncle, and that also includes, of course, Trump's family and some of the people that we're dealing with in relation to this. That's Tesla, of course, Vannevar Bush, Morris Jessup, Carlos Allende. I mean, this is, it's going to get us into some wild territory as we get through this tonight. Now, this whole thing kicks off on this rather remarkable discovery that I made and announced on the Alex Jones Show, actually, on July 20th. And it's fair in black and white. It's easily verified. Defense One and so many other publications have carried this. Washington Times, Washington Post, New York Times, and others. What we're looking at now is there's this incredible South Korean company that is putting together the headquarters of the Golden Dome. And this is no small project, believe me. They're going deep, deep now, trying to basically establish this. And what I realized about the location in that Philly shipyard that rang a bell back there about the Philadelphia experiment and all the incredible things that we've discovered in relation to that, it's the exact location where the USS Eldridge was there and then was teleported in 1943, according to the Philadelphia experiment legend, to Norfolk, Virginia. And spent some time there and was picked up on radar. And, you know, certain people could see it, certain people couldn't. And then it teleported back. And there were unexpected results, including the trapped matter and the trapped naval men who were there in this kind of interface of the whole thing. And so this story all linked in directly with Einstein's research into the unified field and all his tensor torsion papers from 1928. So the project had been going on for a while, and we were in the throes of World War II. Looking very deeply at this now, you can see that there was very deep call here for something, a number of experiments to be tried. And of course, the Nazis were doing their own at this point, looking at the Nazi Bell and their first atomic experiments. So the whole thing was going into this hyperdimensional phase, and where it was going to stop with the torsion physics and with the hyperdimensionality teleportation. I mean, there are a lot of things going on there that have come to fruition and come to roost, really, if you look at it here in 2026. We're going to get into all of it tonight in this very, very special episode. And one of the things I'm going to do, of course, is a huge UFO release today. I'm going to make some commentary on that as well, as go deep, deep now into what they're doing in relation to this version of disclosure, which I think really has to be called Disclosure Light or Disclosure CIA version. And it doesn't get us into the really deep, deep territory of the UFO file. One of the things I want to put across in relation to this is that, you know, President Trump has come into the second term with a lot of clout that he didn't have in the first term. And that's good and bad. You can see it's bad in relation to Iran and the number of heroics and things and the braggadocio and the militarization that's going on in relation to that. And also getting us involved with foreign policy partners who aren't really up to the job, up to the task of protecting our interests in the region. And so we have a whole heck of a lot of problems that we're being manipulated into, including changing the name of the Department of Defense to the Department of War, which is absurd. As we know, it's still the Department of Defense. They're just using that for, you know, memos and everything else, Department of War. And that's where they want to go. Of course, they'd have to get both houses of Congress and the executive branch signing off on that. It hasn't happened. This is very important because, you know, the Department of Defense, their job is to literally protect the interests of the citizens of the United States. And when you go over and get involved in this altercation in Iran, it doesn't look like anything even close to that is happening. We have to be aware of some of those dynamics as we go in. But when it comes to the UFO file and President Trump, there's a deep, deep history, as we know, and we're getting into that at night as well. Uncle John Trump, of course, being deep with Vannevar Bush. But how close is that to the Philadelphia experiment? And is the headquarters of the Golden Dome being right where the Philadelphia experiment took place the big ultimate giveaway as to what John Trump found there in that hotel room, in that safe where he was sent in by Vannevar Bush, the FBI, and the Office of Alien Property? All of that, was that something that now is catapulting the situation of the Golden Dome being there right in that Philly shipyard? This is what we're going to look at tonight. And I'll tell you, from my early looks at the entire situation, it looks very much like we're looking at the UFO file, we're looking at exotic technology, and we're looking at this overlap of some 80 years since the experiment took place. We're going to start off literally in 1943 in October, and we're going to move that, stretch that out, and bring us into the 1950s. And a very interesting person who was an astronomer, professor of astronomy, and also was somebody who had a varied career, so much so that I think of him as kind of a renegade from various mystery schools and things of this nature. The five lives concept going on behind some of these figures. And that is Morris Jessup, who brought forward the book The Case for the UFO in 1955. When we look at 1955, it's a key year. There's a number of things that are happening. But the presence of Jessup, I think, in the heart of all this, really, I think, brings it to a different level. Because one of the things we're looking at with Jessup is, here is somebody who had been involved with archaeology, somebody who'd been in the hot zone looking for ruins, been in Yucatan looking for ruins of Atlantis, been in South America, had started a coffee, company. And also, I think with Jessup, his close association with the rubber trade. And if you look at that in terms of, you know, his association now with Ford and the things that Ford was doing with rubber, and then what happened eventually is that rubber became the hardcore property for stealth technology. All these things certainly run together, as does the untimely death of Dr. Morris Jessup. So we're going to go deep into all of it tonight. And I'll tell you where it leads, the earthquake of the Golden Dome being headquartered in the same Philly shipyard where the Philadelphia experiment dematerialization took place. We cannot overestimate just how important this was. Now, we need to understand a couple of things right off the bat. That when we're talking about the Golden Dome, this is the project now estimated at $1.4 trillion. Yes, that's trillion with a T. When we think of it that way, we have to really understand that this is the leftover, this is the aftermath of the Strategic Defense Initiative under the Reagan administration, which was ostensibly set up to shoot down ICBMs that would be carrying nuclear warheads from the Russians. Now, there are a number of interesting characters who are related to the UFO file directly involved with SDI. And of course, what we got from Gorbachev about his Reykjavik 1987 meeting with Reagan is all about how SDI Star Wars was actually a UFO defense grid built to shoot down these UFOs that were coming in and using our airspace with no penalty going back and forth. Now, one of the things I think is rather fascinating about what's come out in relation to Gorbachev and that conversation is that that conversation now took some 30 years to rise to the surface. And of course, Gorbachev and Reagan are both dead now. But President Trump himself has said, you know, this is exactly what I was talking about. Reagan had it, and we didn't have the full technology to implement it then. But now it's this incredible thing, we can actually shoot down hypersonic missiles before they're coming in and all the rest. Well, when you think about what he's trying to tell us there, he's basically saying, you know, here's the signaling. This is the UFO defense grid. Version 2. That's where you're getting all of the various things in relation to UFO disclosure, including the Presidential Unsealing and Reporting System for UAP Encounters, or PURSU. Well, PURSU is one of those acronyms that you just have to stop there and wonder for a minute, what are they really getting at? Who are you pursuing exactly? The idea of, you know, UFO pursuit, and this is what we're talking about in relationship to this, because when you're dealing with the UFO file, you're dealing with the UFO threat, part, which comes from the CIA, that's the false part. And then you have the real UFO file about dealing with these craft that are using our space and the beings that are involved and the abductions that happen and the apotheum effects, missing time, and the various reality distortion physics that take place. When we look at these, you know, we're starting to get into territory that really tells us this is a big, big, massive geopolitical global problem. And how do you deal with rolling that out? Well, what a number of presidents have done really has been to go along with the system, as it were. You know, go along to get along has been the way that they've done it, and it has made sense in the past. The problem is with Trump's knowledge of the UFO file, he's tried to use it as leverage and tried to, as JFK did, pull that back under executive control. This is a crucial aspect and a crucial idea. President Reagan tried it. A number of presidents were thwarted in relation to doing this. I guess that's the main point I want to put across, including President Nixon, who also was preparing his version for disclosure so he could run for a third term in 1976. So, you know, when you start to realize the length and the history and how this is involved, then it all starts to make a little more sense. We get a better idea of what's happening here. So you've got the Golden Dome, this incredible now pork barrel project of a defense grid on one hand. I'm not saying something like that isn't necessary at some point, but to identify it for what it is, a UFO grid, would be crucial in the first place. And I do feel that they're going to have to identify a UFO threat in order to justify the cost around this, which originally was set up to be $175 billion. Well, what happened to that figure? That's long, long gone. So, you know, we have to keep in mind what it is that they're doing in relation to building these things up in the background. By the time it's done now, some of their enemies of the administration, you know, the Democrats and stuff, are saying, oh, that's a $4 trillion project. Well, just how big is this thing going to be? That's the question. And we're going to get into all of that as we move along here. Before we go any further, I want to remind you to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our newsletter. That is a free newsletter, but it keeps us in touch through the massive censorship that we've been seeing. And there's lots and lots of that to go around. But this is kind of a direct pipeline and it's free. It lets you know the incredible, and I mean incredible, interviews we have coming up for you later this summer, and the remarkable X-Series, mind-blowing X-Series episodes, and of course documentaries, the docuseries, JFK and the UFO file, The Craze and the Hot Zone, and that is all about the Atlantis, Bimini, and a Cuba connection, and we've unearthed so many things there. It's all there in that newsletter. So stand up and be counted. Make sure you go to darkjournalist.com and get your name there so we can make sure you're up to date on all of it. Okay, so now we understand the Golden Dome is there and it's to shoot down these hypersonic missiles and all that. One of the interesting things that a company called Blue Halo suggested, as they were picked to be part of this, and of course Palantir is in there, SpaceX, you know, all the baddies and the goodies mixed together. There's a huge surveillance aspect to this Golden Dome, which I'll get into as we go along here as well. It's kind of like Big Brother in space, basically. But one of the aspects in looking at the Golden Dome is this Blue Halo company. And what's interesting is the person who was doing a lot of, you know, kind of extra work for them and was advising them, even though he was retired and running the UFO file, was General William McCasland, who went missing on February 27th. Now, and that spread to really set off a number of different people disappearing in relation to the UFO file. These were missing scientists, the dead scientists, you know, and it goes all the way back to Amy Eskridge and some others, who were very early to putting the word out that this level of disclosure was coming. It was going to be kind of false disclosure and that the real thing was being held back. There were a lot of voices saying that it was down there in Huntsville that the real work was going on. And of course, with the Project Paperclip overlay of Huntsville, then, you know, this starts to become quite an intrigue. In the 12 episodes that we did on it, they were covered by CNN, Rolling Stone, Time Magazine. I mean, mainstream media coverage for dark journalist work and dark journalism is shocking. But you can see we caught this kind of organic fire of the story and brought it all the way up to the level of the White House. So the White House had that story and they said, we're looking deeply into this. And Kash Patel said, you know, oh, we're going to make sure we get to the bottom of where these scientists are going. And can it be more than a coincidence? Yeah, certainly more than a coincidence when over a dozen of them go missing in the period of just a couple of years. And I want to add Mark McCandlish, who was part of the original Secret Space conferences that we did. He was a part of that group that died mysteriously, and he was using his incredible artistic talents as he drew these craft for the Air Force for decades, and now he was exposing all of their secret craft and the number of things that they were keeping at different bases that were definitely either hybrid craft or were definitely rediscovered and redeveloped UFOs. This is important because when we talk about, you know, the subject matter, there's a kind of a boom cliche about a whistleblower, and, you know, there's the whole kind of Bob Lazar type Area 51 story. And that's part of the lore back there. But the way it impacts people's lives when it's the real deal, and with a guy like McCandlish, who really felt under pressure there, and he was eliminated under very strange circumstances. Amy Eskridge, of course, the scientist also down there in Huntsville, and her dad being very, very big in aerospace as a NASA engineer. You know, she was somebody who said, well, McCandlish's death is suspicious, no question about it. And then she was gone very shortly. So you can see, you know, her death was very mysterious as well. These people are found, you know, in secluded areas with a shotgun and, you know, shotgun blast to the back of their head or something. It doesn't make any sense. And it, you know, if you've watched any of the Dark Journalist shows dealing with the Kennedy assassinations and the way that witnesses are eliminated when you get around certain things. And that gets us, I mean, of course, to 9/11 and other cases as well. One of the clearest cases is that whenever around the Kennedy assassination, they would bring forward these committees, whether it was in the 60s with the Warren Commission or after that with the House Assassinations Committee, in the 90s with the Association Record Review Board, you know, of assassinations, there were deaths associated with each one of these, and some of them very high profile deaths. Some of the mafia figures, for example, that died during the late 1970s in relation to this, would just show up, you know, Sam Giancana, who'd been the godfather for how many years, and then shows up dead as soon as he gets a congressional subpoena. So, and it goes all the way up to that high level. And then you have somebody as low level as the person who was driving the cab that the Warren Commission said Oswald had taken a cab, you know, to his rooming house. That guy ends up dead very shortly after giving that testimony. And was Oswald even in a cab, you know, or was he being driven off by his handlers? So there's an awful lot of buttoning up and wrapping up different story narratives that we need to understand. Karen Kupcinet, who was somebody who was an aspiring actress, and she dies under mysterious circumstances. She has a lot of high-profile Hollywood friends, and her dad was a big news guy. He was a big media guy in Chicago and continued to be very, very close friends with Jack Ruby. And the day before the assassination, there she is making these telephone calls, trying to get the operator to connect her to the FBI to say, you know, President Kennedy is going to be assassinated. Well, let's take that straight up for what it is. She had inside information. She tried to find a way to get it out there. As soon as it was understood that she was doing this, she's eliminated under very suspicious circumstances, even though she's a very high profile aspiring actress in Hollywood. Certainly, you know, the X-Protect group who handles that type of lethal activity does not discriminate. If you're in, you know, entertainment or if you're in politics, they will do the job, as it were. So we need to understand that in relation to the missing scientists. It's not an aberration. It's not something that just comes out of the blue. It is a pattern, especially when you're dealing with the UFO aspect and the secrecy around it and the people who control that secrecy on the type of level that we're discussing. And that would be, you know, units inside the aerospace companies, units inside of the intelligence community. And this X-Protect group, which grew up between the aerospace defense contractors and the intelligence community, who is specifically in charge of handling the secrecy around the UFO file, that's what we've put on the record. And some of the biggest counterintelligence people that are, you know, names in the UFO field now came to me, you know, like David Grush and others, and said, oh, yeah, you know, when you were talking about X-Protect, that's exactly what I discovered. And I was on the inside, you know. So there's been a number of confirmations about the X-Protect group. If you go way back in history and look at the people like Donald Kehoe, the really brave people in the 50s and 60s around the UFO file, close friend of Lindbergh's, you know, a military veteran and all the rest. And he ran all these UFO committees. And what Kehoe said was there was something called the silence group. And they would come to different people in the Air Force and the military and say, don't mention anything about this or else. We've had another of very high profile figures like Gordon Cooper, the Gemini astronaut, you know, famous for all of his missions, you know, working for NASA, von Braun and the whole thing. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, we witnessed UFOs. We had films of UFOs and they were lying about it on such a regular basis. And it was lie upon lie upon lie upon lie. And they didn't, you know how to put the genie back in the bottle. It's very important for us to understand this because then we understand, okay, you have this UFO grid. That's the Golden Dome. One, then the Golden Dome is being set up and headquartered in the Philly shipyard. Well, the Philly shipyard is where they had the Philadelphia experiment. That ties us back to 1943. Who dies in 1943? Nikola Tesla, the incredible inventor who certainly knew a great deal about X technology and worked it through the system. And he wanted to really create this free wireless power situation. But his ideas were so advanced and he was so shut down because they didn't want these things coming out to an unwitting public who would really latch on to some of the freedom that would be involved in getting, you know, wireless energy beamed the same way we beam communications. So, you know, that story is thick there with JP Morgan and Westinghouse and others in the background. But it tells us a great deal. If we go a little bit further back, we can see Tesla meeting with the then Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and that was future president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They were looking into these special types of magnetic fields and the different things they could do with them and how they could be weaponized and all the rest. That was during World War I and into the 1920s. That period there is the setup, because when you get to 1928, you've got Einstein sitting there with his tensor torsion ideas and Project Rainbow and these different things. That is about invisibility and teleportation. And when you get into that level, then you're looking at a whole different ballgame. And this is the part that's been left out of the history book. This is what relates us back to the UFO file. And that's where we're going next, directly from the Philly shipyard to Morris Jessup's UFO file work. So we have a number of these historic interactions between figures like FDR, Tesla, Einstein, and others. I'm going to introduce somebody who's not so historically known, and that is Carlos Allende, or Carl Allen, or one of his various other names. Well, this is somebody who's well known in relation to the Philadelphia experiment, but he was just a merchant marine, and he was not somebody who was privileged to be on the inside or anything of that nature. What just happened to be that he was on a particular ship, and that ship's name was the SS Andrew Furuseth. And while he was aboard that ship, he witnessed the experiment. And he had occasion to meet Einstein at a certain point when Einstein was coming in and working and doing things with ONI and others and actually teaching some of their people physics, some of the students and some of the naval recruits and others. And I think what we want to keep in mind in relation to this is that, you know, there are people who show up in these mysterious ways in histories. Well, in Allende's case, and I think really we want to think about his work annotating the book called The Case for the UFO. Now, The Case for the UFO is a breakthrough book, and I want to say this about Jessup, who was unceremoniously taken care of, shall we say, by the X-Protect group, the same group that had, you know, 8 years earlier unceremoniously dumped James Forrestal at a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Very close friend of JFK. The handwriting was on the wall there as well. These things kind of move together. When you think of that book, The Case for the UFO, it took the entire subject matter, and this is, I think, the crucial detail in relation to all this. It took the entire subject matter to a much higher level, because here's an academic, here's somebody who's well-versed in astronomy, here's somebody with a really good background, very articulate, who will go on radio shows, who will go on TV shows, talk about the subject matter. And he is a loose cannon in relation to these people. That is Morris Jessup. And as I said, with his five lives there behind him of Atlantean archaeologists there in Central America, in South America, you know, working with this rubber factory, working with the various things having to do with his coffee company, all the incredible contacts that he had established, he's coming out with a book like Case for the UFO. Consequently, he will also come up with the whole concept of ancient aliens, as it were, a long, long, you know, good decade or more before the Chariots of the Gods and Eric von Daniken and all the rest of it. So keep that in mind, that we're looking at somebody who's a very dynamic character and somebody who's really putting it across that, you know, UFOs in the Bible and all the rest of it. So he's bringing the UFO thing into a scientifically acceptable level, and then he's tapping into this religious question that would naturally come up: were UFOs involved in any of these major religious things like Ezekiel's wheel or manna from heaven and the incredible ships that were guiding the Israelites in the desert at the time? So, you know, these are very advanced concepts, and he was the one putting them forward. He was a very articulate person. Now, what's happened originally with the book is that it got sent to Jessup, but then it got sent to the Office of Naval Research. And there's a big suggestion there that Allende had all kinds of contacts from his time in the military, and that he sent it to specific people there. And what happens is they read the various annotated versions of the book. So you have the book itself, and then all of Allende's various annotations. And there's somebody that he's going back and forth with on those. So the color of the annotation changes. And I don't know if that is just Allende creating conversational template in order to do this, or and he's writing it all or not. That never became very clear. But what I think is interesting is out of those conversations, they say this Philadelphia invisibility experiment happened in October 1943, and that this person witnessed it, and also that it is related directly to UFO propulsion and anti-gravity and all the rest of it. Now, later on, various researchers like Charles Berlitz, they'd be the ones who come out with the Philadelphia experiment books and really go deep into the history around it. They would find Thomas Townsend Brown dealing around this. And there's a time travel thing that gets brought in with it. There's even a 1980s movie about the Philadelphia experiment. So it's been, you know, in the zeitgeist. It has been in that kind of corridor of imagination, you might say, in the corridor of fact, fiction, street legend, and all the rest. But the fact that Jessup was so involved with this, and the fact that Allende's information was so advanced, takes the entire project up to another level, especially when we look at Einstein's research into invisibility as a way, remember, to win against the Japanese and to win against the Germans and all the rest of it, which certainly Einstein was on board for 100% helping the government do that. So they had a number of these different projects, but this one through Allende comes out. So what happens is that book and the annotations is so advanced that it goes to the very top high levels in the Navy and elsewhere in the military and intelligence circles. And they say, we really need to get this distributed to a number of our guys. And they make their own edition called the Vero edition, which is literally from the print shop. And it goes out to these different people. That piece creates incredible stress around our friend Jessup, and it puts him on the radar in a very unhealthy way, because now the whole thing about anti-gravity, the whole piece about the apotheum effect, the Philadelphia experiment, its relationship to the UFO file, all of these things are coming out in succession. So we're looking at it, and they're looking at him, and they're saying, huh, you know, if this goes any further, here we have this legitimate guy. Now we have this thing. Is this a coordinated leak? What's going on? They know that this is the really, truly deep info. And they also know about the invisibility project, its relation to time travel, and its relation to the UFO file. All of that is in there in Allende's annotations. And he's a very mysterious figure. Again, you know, there have been people who have tried to debunk Allende over the years, and they've said, aha, I found him. He's living in a house, you know, in Texas. Well, that's it. You know, there's no way to debunk what he wrote because it's so erudite on a scientific physics level. There are a number of people that have looked at this. So then you say, well, what is it? What's going on here? Well, Allende, if he did witness this invisibility aspect, and if he did plug in to the secret physics projects that were going on, he recognized in the Case for the UFO book by Jessup that this is somebody who was on the level, you know, who could really understand and appreciate this. And he wanted to give him that extra piece of the annotated version. And he also wanted to get this on board, sensing there's some group that's tuned into this, and there's another group that's completely keeping them out of the loop. So he's a great equalizer, you might say, in terms of the information and history. And there's a great deal of physics involved here, including the idea of the unified field and other pieces. What I want to stress about it all is that what you have is the UFO file rising to the surface too early, the true implications of it. So when we're taken back now to 1943, in January, Nikola Tesla dies. Then John Trump is sent in by the head of the UFO file, Vannevar Bush. Now, a lot of people might say, you know, oh, was there a UFO file in 1943? Definitely there was. You know, certainly Roswell and the other things expanded it gigantically, and that's where you got MJ-12 and all the rest. But the UFO file had been active. You can look at cases going all the way back to the 1920s, certainly since 1941 in Cape Girardeau. But what had been going on, and we know from subsequent physicists who've come out and many risked their lives, and others like Robert Sarbarker, the great physicist who I quote very often on this program. And one of the things that he had to say was, the UFO file is the highest national security secret of them all, beyond nuclear. And God knows the exotic technology that resides between those two. So when we see it from that particular vantage point, we can see this starts to make a lot more sense. So the question is, from that, you know, entry into Tesla's papers, when they send in John Trump, who then is the person who's the protege of Vannevar Bush, and Vannevar Bush will serve 7 administrations. Okay, how deep in the warp and woof of government is this guy, all the way through to Nixon? I mean, you know, this is somebody who was a major player in all of it. And Sarbarker identified him as the leader of the UFO file, along with others like Arthur Compton as well. So when we look at it from that point of view, and we have John Trump there, Professor Trump at MIT, as Vannevar Bush's, who's the dean of the school, you know, it's his protege and somebody he's putting out, and the incredible secrecy that Vannevar Bush developed using Masonic methods for secrecy around the UFO file, then we're starting to go places. We're starting to move. And we see in 43, this happens. And one of the strange things, if you go into that history, as we've done in a number of episodes, of course, we're the ones who brought forward the deep information about John Trump and his relationship to Tesla and the UFO file. There were things that were there about Trump, but nobody realized, you know, there's even some work from Colonel Corso and others, and it's just like, yeah, there's this mysterious character, John Trump, back there. They didn't realize the relationship to Vannevar Bush, and of course, they didn't really know him in relation to Donald Trump, because Donald Trump was, you know, one of these big financial players and one of the major figures in the 80s and 90s, but he wasn't a presidential candidate at that point, or any kind of politician. So they just didn't connect the two. And so there were wonderful things that were put on the record, but we got the deep relationships in the background of John Trump and Tesla and the UFO file. And then we also got that deep history between Trump and President Nixon. Now, these things become very, very important, because what you have there is Trump working, John Trump working with the material, with the UFO knowledge in the background, and also on setting up what would be the basis of CERN. Okay, CERN and the Large Hadron Collider, ostensibly set up to find the Higgs boson, the God particle, right? And now we know it's a gigantic sprawling project that's going to be five times bigger by 2030. CERN 2 basically has the, you know, five times as large as the original particle smasher. And a number of unusual things have been reported in relationship to that. We've incorporated it into some of our episodes and documentaries and done some of the deepest work around CERN. I'm going to show a clip here about some of the CERN research that has not been really out there as much, just to give us a background on it. And then we're going to come back to how John Trump's work relates directly to the Philadelphia experiment, CERN, and the Tesla papers.
Okay, so how does CERN play a role in all of this then?
Well, this is fascinating because CERN, now, they did the Hadron Collider, the Large Hadron Collider, in Switzerland. And CERN is quite interesting because it's sort of a breakthrough between modern technology and ancient technology. But what it was set up for was set up by the scientists to find the God particle. But it had a $21 billion budget, which is very strange in any scientific circle. So people started to wonder immediately, is there some military purpose behind it? And I dug into CERN and the collider and found very odd things, including the fact that they had a huge scandal there for doing an occult ritual that got caught on camera in front of CERN. And the Hadron Collider becomes this thing that's sort of worshipped in these scientific circles because they're worshipping this incoming of a communication from another dimension. Technically, CERN is set up to find the God particle. Higgs boson is what they call it. But with that big budget, everyone assumed something else was going on. And so then they started to create papers about it and saying, no, you know, all those rumors are false. There's nothing strange going on. We're just looking for the Higgs boson. But then they found it. So technically you'd think, okay, their work is moving on to something else. This thing about particle colliding is quite fascinating. Deep, deep in the literature, if you look into it, these scientists say, we're trying to contact another dimension through CERN, through the Hadron Collider, in fact. So they've mapped out gigantic tunnels there in France, Switzerland, and other places. And they are using this as a gigantic particle smasher. Somehow in the middle of all that, they recreate the conditions, they say, of the Big Bang. And so then the whole concept of strangelets came up. And this is interesting. A group of scientists sued CERN because they said, your Higgs boson particle smashing experiments can release strangelets. And guess what? Strangelets can form black holes. And if you form a black hole, you can suck up a country, or, you know, it's a big problem basically to create a black hole. So they sued them, and then they tried to find out who owned CERN and who was actually doing this. Then they found out that CERN was a sovereign country and that the way it was set up was very much like Vatican City or something like this. There was no way to sue them. They are their own independent thing. So, digging in a little deeper on CERN gets us into occult territory because there's a whole occult wing inside of CERN which thinks that they can use the technology to interact with beings, intelligences that are on a different dimension, literally. So that's very much like the Two-Eye Stone in that sense. And you can see that the CERN Hadron Collider is sort of Atlantean-style technology. It's also very innovative, kept very tight and underground, and has a funny, you know, sort of, you know, they had Tom Hanks start it up. He was like, hey, I'm going to start it up. It's CERN, Large Hadron Collider. I'm going to flip the switch. You know, they have their PR thing, but it's a very strange project, highly funded. And now other countries are looking at CERN and trying to develop their own, saying, we think it's a weapon. It actually has a weapons use. So I think when we're talking about technology that is kind of a spiritual technology that could be misused, CERN is a good modern example.
That's so interesting. And the PR, I'm sure they brought in.
Oh, yeah. Tom Hanks likes it.
Well, so.
Okay, so it's starting to get a little spooky in relationship to what CERN is up to. And let's look at some of the origins, though, here with the Philadelphia Experiment. Now, Philadelphia Experiment takes place about 10 months after that, going into Tesla's hotel room, basically breaking in there and getting that information. If you look deeply into the record, there's a very strange story about someone who was a safecracker and basically a burglar for the United States government. And he's sent over and he does all these things in Vichy France and, you know, occupied territories where he's going back behind enemy lines and he's breaking into German headquarters and stealing things out of their safes. And he writes a very interesting book called Surreptitious Entry, which I think is a classic. And I've brought it forward, and it's a very unusual book with him sort of bragging in these James Bond terms about the different ways he's been dropped into enemy territory and gotten papers out of these safes that no one else could get. But one of the interesting things, if you go back into that original story around John Trump, is there were various locations for Nikola Tesla's papers. One of those locations was right in his New York City hotel room. And that is the kind of crucial story. But before that, they go to a storage space and there are 80 different trunks that have this Tesla, you know, advanced experiments and all the different paperwork that's associated with it. Well, it's interesting with Tesla because, you know, he has his own understanding of what to release to humanity and, you know, how to bring it out in the right way and have it not get into the wrong hands. So I'm certain there are things that he was doing that, you know, to ensure that. But one of the things that was understood is that he kept his most important papers in his safe in his hotel room. So from now, the storage space in New York City, he is heading John Trump directly to the hotel room that has, you know, the belongings of the deceased inventor. And when he gets there, one of the things he notices of the people with him who are assigned to be with him, he doesn't recognize the function of one of them. It says civilian investigator. And that's the unusual thing here. The civilian investigator was, in fact, Willis George, the very same spy burglar who was bragging about his prowess as a safecracker for the U.S. government. So this is the same exact person. And he is a member of the OSS. And as soon as Trump sees that, he becomes nervous about this person who was assigned there. And the question that is not clear in the record is, did Willis George beat John Trump directly to Tesla's hotel room? This is the unusual question about it. There are questions lingering about what was going on there because they had sent Trump first to the storage warehouse. And when he saw this civilian investigator and then later realized he was an OSS agent, he had misgivings about this guy being on the list there of people who were assisting him. So let's keep that in mind as we go here now, that somebody may have beaten Trump to Tesla's papers at the hotel. Now, let's look at it from this point of view also. Trump, after the fact, you know, like a week later, has to come out and say, well, I've reviewed the papers and there were a lot of hypothetical things in there, but nothing that was really, you know, a death ray or things of that nature. In fact, the group that had sent him in there, the FBI group, said, we're looking specifically for information about taking down flying objects at a distance. Now, this is very interesting because if you put unidentified in front of that, you get the whole picture because, of course, it was the FBI that would give us the acronym later, and also they would also give us the X-Files through the figure of Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister, such a deep state operator, closely associated investigating UFO cases, the first person who was going out there to Idaho and Washington and Oregon in that whole corridor of the Pacific Northwest and investigating those cases for the FBI. He becomes somebody who is the coach there and the employer of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963 in the summer of New Orleans. When you put those two things together, you start to see, again, that strange footprint of the UFO file around these very big, deep events in history, like the Kennedy assassination in that case. So keep that in mind as we're looking into this here. Also, some of the strange connections that we have building up for experimental results at CERN and ultimately experimental results in Antarctica. These things all seem to relate directly now to the experimental work that was happening in the Philadelphia shipyard where we got the Philadelphia experiment. I'm going to bring them all together. And one of the things I want to do, I'm going to play a brief clip here about Antarctica and some of the strange connections here directly related to JFK and then what he was trying to prevent there about something being set up in Antarctica that was going to be a super secret weapons development UFO file center. Very important to understand the linkage there of Lloyd Berkner and the physicist who Kennedy was going to meet. He was on his way to meet when he was assassinated. They were about to have this major event there at the trademark. We'll go to this clip from my documentary and JFK, the final speech in the UFO file, and then we'll come back.
This is fascinating because Byrd takes Berkner under his wing at a very early age, as we mentioned.
22.
And if you think about your experiences at 22, you know, going to Antarctica for 2 years is pretty incredible. It'll leave quite a mark on your life. But what I found when I was dealing with Berkner and Byrd is that over and over again, including the fact that they both went back to Antarctica in 1956, was quite fascinating. It showed that relationship continued on. But the relationship as it gets into the JFK assassination is quite interesting because everywhere I looked into the crime of the JFK assassination, I kept finding people associated with two things, the UFO file and Antarctica. And I tried to put together, why would Antarctica be a part of it? But I'll give you an example. So when Lee Harvey Oswald signs up for a job at the Texas School Book Depository, and, you know, we're here at the 61st anniversary of the crime of the century, last century. He's walking in and signing up for a job, and the owner of the building is someone who heads up an experimental aerospace company named LTV, Ling Temco Vought. And that company, it's very interesting, I'll say this as an aside, they invested $3 million shortly before the Kennedy assassination. And they ended up being one of the largest Vietnam War contracts making all of these various aerospace devices. So that $3 million investment from the owner of the Texas School Book Depository, who owned LTV, turned into $55 million by 1965. Think about the money, that kind of money in 1965. That's an incredible increase. But this is the kind of things that you can see in the background of that. But this character, D.H. Byrd, who owned the Texas School Book Depository, where the shots were fired from, allegedly, in the Warren Commission, his name was David H. Byrd, but they called him Dryhole Byrd because he was an oil man. And he was the cousin of Admiral Byrd, who'd done the famous Antarctica expeditions. He was also the cousin of Harry Byrd, who was the senator who headed up all the NASA funding. So we're in an interesting place, I think, with this guy, right off the bat, that there's an Antarctica connection. As soon as they make that turn onto Elm Street from the limousine where the shots are fired, they're going right past a building that D.H. Byrd, whose cousin discovered Antarctica, is those shots are coming from there. So D.H. Byrd, it turns out, funded all the expeditions to Antarctica. He's the main funder. As a matter of fact, there's something called D.H. Byrd Mountain in Antarctica. Well, that's the owner of the Texas School Book Depository. So when we get into it now, we're looking at an unusual figure who is connected deeply with Lyndon Baines Johnson. So that is the person who will assume the presidency when President Kennedy is assassinated. So you can see we're in deep waters once you start looking at it past the Warren Commission and past the superficial media treatment. You're dealing with very deep players. And obviously Antarctica is where the kind of high technology aspect comes in. But Byrd with LTV was already, this is an experimental aerospace company. And you know, my basic thing around the JFK assassination is, it's all aerospace everywhere you look. It is aerospace interests. Somehow, aerospace and NASA, that piece is where the JFK, the root of the assassination, comes from.
That is so interesting.
I know, we're into space, we're into Antarctica.
Well, and all the connections around it too. So how does Operation High Jump and Deep Freeze Reveal and Antarctica UFO file link, and why are Admiral Byrd's secret diary and papers still classified today?
This is the thing. We talk about the JFK records being locked up 61 years later. And the main records that are kept on the JFK side are the CIA files. There's a famous conversation that Judge Napolitano came out with, and he's a big libertarian judge. He does a lot of TV spots. And he talks about talking with President Trump at the end of his term in 2020 and saying, hey, you know that thing you promised to do, releasing the JFK files, are you going to do that before you leave? And Trump said, no, I can't do it. And Napolitano said, well, you know, you promised to do this. Aren't you going to release the records? You don't want to treat the American public like children, like they've been waiting so many years for these files to come out. And what Napolitano said is that Trump said to him, Andrew, if you knew what was in those records, you would never release them. So whatever sits inside of those CIA records around JFK, there's a reason that they sat on them. And people over the years have said to me, well, wouldn't they be able to erase a document or delete it? Like, nothing's going to be in there when they come out. Well, I found out about an interesting meeting that Robert Kennedy, who was the attorney general at the time, the brother of President Kennedy, had with the CIA director 4 hours after the assassination at a farm in Virginia. Whatever booby trap that Kennedy put into those files made it so that if they took a certain thing out, it would set off all these alarm bells in the Justice Department and everywhere else. So this back and forth over the files has to do with the fact that something's sitting there inside the files that would reveal a great deal. Now let's go to Byrd and his files. Operation High Jump is very mysterious, very unusual for a lot of reasons. One, it happens in the same year as the Roswell UFO incident, 1947. It's set up in 1946, and it has a lot of the very familiar players, including Admiral Byrd's son, and I'll get to him later because it's an unusual thing that he's there. He's a 22-year-old Navy guy. But he ends up being part of this team. Operation High Jump went down there. Now, this is 4,700 men. It is 13 ships. It's 23 planes. And this is all to navigate and explore Antarctica. All the records from High Jump are locked up. You can't get access to them. They're classified by the United States government. Now, you think 61 years is a long time to wait. Well, you know, try almost 80 years. So there's something unusual about High Jump, but there always was. Here's a few things that leaked out over the years. One, they ended High Jump in only 6 weeks. They were supposed to be there for 6 months. They got out of there fast for some reason.
We still don't know.
The only thing that we have is a weird thing that happened with Byrd himself. So Admiral Byrd comes back to Chile after this, and he gets asked by a reporter what happened, what's going on. And he says, well, we're past World War II, but now we have to prepare to fight these new enemy fighters because we were all attacked by discs. And so the story spreads around everywhere. When they went to Antarctica, whatever it was that they saw, they thought, oh, there must be a base of another military here because we're basically under attack. Or you could say they were spooked enough to think they were under attack. They saw something quite unusual. Now remember, Byrd had been to Antarctica many times. He knew what to expect. So whatever it was that he saw when he came there freaked him out. And he said, we now have an enemy that can fly from pole to pole, so we have a totally new order of war coming. This is Byrd's testimony. Now, as soon as he comes back and gives that, that story goes all over the world. Well, they call him in for some heavy meetings and they say, you're not talking to the press. You're not talking to your family. You're not talking to the State Department about any of this stuff. That's the end of
high jumped. You're not going to mention it ever again. As a matter of fact, Bird only shows up again in 1955 in a TV interview. That's the only thing he'll ever do again publicly. And he says unusual things again about Antarctica, just saying it's going to save the world. Eventually, mankind is going to need Antarctica. But it's spooky the way that he goes into it, because what we find with him is he's a military man. He does not mince words. For him to have freaked out and shared this with this Chilean reporter, obviously, when he got down there, something was very out of hand, and they took that whole armada of men, planes, and boats, 4,700 guys, pushed them all back after only 6 weeks. And the question always remained, what happened to them? What did they see? Well, if you go a little further along the history, it's quite interesting, because Admiral Byrd's son, he was part of High Jump, and after his dad died, he inherited his papers, and he was going to open a museum and all this stuff. So what happens in the 1980s is he gets invited to speak by the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C., and come down there and say, well, you know, talk all about your dad, talk about High Jump and everything that happened there. And he says, okay, you know, I'm headed down. And he lived in Boston. As a matter of fact, it's a funny thing, I'll say as a little aside, that I worked in a cafe when I was 15 years old, and I had to walk by his house every day in Beacon Hill. And I, you know, who would ever know it? But when I look back on the history now, I see, oh, that's the same house that I walked by every day. It was Admiral Byrd's son's house. So it's very interesting what happened to him. And this is what I'm going to kind of get into, this idea of X-Protect here. He's going now, and he says, I'm going to give this speech. And his son lets him off on the train, and he set up a whole thing about who he's going to meet in D.C. and all the rest. Well, he disappears. Now, he turns up a month later dead in a warehouse in Baltimore, Maryland. He's dehydrated, he's malnourished, and he doesn't have the same clothes on that he left with. So all of the different explanations for his death don't make any sense. But what happened was, for some reason, he stopped in Baltimore, went to the warehouse district, got into a warehouse, and died, instead of giving his speech in Washington, D.C. about Operation High Jump. So we can see that there's a heavy, heavy level of tracking people who were involved with projects like that. And again, it goes back to this advanced aerospace project, which that is the thing that they've been testing in Antarctica, and we'll get into it. I want to say, to wrap up the story about the sun, that the only person who saw him the whole time he was in Baltimore was the security guard at one of the warehouses, who said he was walking along with another guy and they were covered in soot. No explanation. He said, but the only thing that struck me as weird is he had one shoe on. And he said he asked me for directions about something, and I realized how well-spoken he was. And this is a very educated guy. He's like, oh, isn't it weird? He's walking around like a homeless person. So whatever it was that happened to Byrd's son is, again, part of this strange obfuscation of High Jump, and the records we can't see. His idea of a museum is gone, and then he himself turns up dead. That has a very familiar ring to it when we get into the UFO file in experimental aerospace.
Yeah, you don't just end up in different clothes.
The story's so unusual, and a lot of people at the period, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, all these different, they looked into it, and they seem baffled. You know, I think with a lot of those newspapers, they're so good at covering things up anyway, but even they were like, what's going on here? You know?
That's a lot of open questions, yeah. But I'll leave them alone.
That's what happened to Richard Byrd Jr.
He walked by his house. Who knew? <I did.
laughs> This is the incredible thing.
So leading in, what are the secret weapons and anti-gravity programs being developed in Antarctica? And how do they relate to the deeper truth in the UFO file?
Well, this is fascinating. One of the people that we've had on the show is John Warner IV, who is the son of Senator Warner and the son of Catherine Mellon, who's the heir to the Mellon fortune. Now, what's fascinating is his dad was involved deeply
as senator and as the director of the Navy in a program called Deep Freeze, and went there on many occasions. As a matter of fact, it's the only trip that he didn't take his son on because of the high level of secrecy involved in the Antarctica program. But his son started to find out as he was getting older, et cetera, that his dad was involved in Majestic 12. As a matter of fact, his dad, Senator Warner, was a member of Majestic. And he decided to ask him, you know, I want some information from you about Antarctica, what's going on down there. And he said, I would love to be able to tell you because it will impact all of humanity. And then at a certain point, he said, all I can tell you is it relates to space. Now, if we go back in the record, it gets very interesting because some of the people deeply involved in aerospace show up in Antarctica. And Wernher von Braun, who is the rocket scientist that set up so much of NASA, was deeply, deeply involved and impacted by a book called Two Planets. And the book, Two Planets, started all of these German scientists thinking about a rocket program. If you go into that book and spend some time with it, it's quite interesting because the whole concept is an alien civilization comes and live. It's a sci-fi novel from 1893. A whole alien civilization comes and lives in Antarctica. That's their natural habitat, as it were. And there's a whole thing about Mars and space travel and all this other thing. So it becomes a great goal of von Braun and some of these other German scientists to actually establish a rocket program so that they can go into space. But also Antarctica becomes an obsession of Nazi scientists and Nazi leadership. As a matter of fact, what they do is they actually hire Byrd and they say, we want you to teach us all the ins and outs about how to get to Antarctica, etc. Now, in the 1930s, when they hired him, we weren't at war with Germany. You know, we were on a kind of a very comfortable status. And a lot of people won't remember this. But in 1936, the Germans and the Nazi Party hosted the Olympics, which is quite extraordinary to think about. And they televised it. So there's this whole kind of wave there where Germany was, you know, still on the national stage. And so they hire Admiral Byrd and they say, we want to go to Antarctica and we want you to give us the ins and the outs. And they go down there and they claim it and they call it Neuschwabenland. And Neuschwabenland is going to be like their future territory. This is Valhalla. And they put all these kind of Arthurian themes and terms around Antarctica, strangely enough. But in the background, what we hear is they were developing a gigantic military base in Antarctica back then. And that by the time you get to Admiral Byrd going back there in 1946, that what he's seeing may be related to the military base the Nazis set up there. This is the lore, and this is also part of the problem with going into Antarctica, is it's such a mystery. It's almost easier to get information about things in space than it is in Antarctica because it's so, you know, kept under. I've talked to people who've worked in Antarctica, and they are held in various skiffs and secure facilities and debriefed about things they can talk about and what they can't talk about. One of the weapons, supposedly, that was being developed there, that was used, was something about being able to cause earthquakes, and so that was being tested there. And there was a gigantic earthquake in the region, and a lot of the people who were involved, as whistleblowers, said this is part of the test of the earthquake technology. Well, if you go into people like Nikola Tesla, and you look at the things that he was doing, you'll find that he has a patent on a machine that causes earthquakes. And the patent comes from 1899. And there's a whole story about how he was dared, you know, can you do this as a scientist? Can you create an earthquake? And he created an earthquake in Manhattan and even faced charges for doing it. So this technology has slid under the radar and is in a series of private interest groups in the hands of these groups. So I'm going to try to identify who some of these groups are and how it relates to people like Birkner, like Byrd, like von Braun, who seem to have a double connection. They're related to the UFO file and they're related to Antarctica research as well. There's some strange connection going on there. And it's very easy to track it, but it's missing from history.
to be charged for an earthquake. Yes. Can you imagine?
And he did it. he also created wireless energy. So, you know, they wanted to make sure he didn't go too far. you can't charge for that.
No.
So we can see there's a number of strange things there in relation to Antarctica to this. And this, again, the exotic technology, the apotheum effect, these things are being experimented upon. And there's some history back here and connections in relation to those people. And what do you have around a lot of these deep events? Experimental aerospace. And, you know, and the company, by the way, that is doing the work in the Philly shipyard for the Golden Dome is Hanwha, and they are a South Korean aerospace company. So you've got aerospace directly in this, and they are the foundation of the Golden Dome, which is what? The UFO defense grid, right? Trump said himself, well, it's Star Wars 2, and, you know, Star Wars 1, as we know from Gorbachev, was set up as the UFO defense grid that Reagan was doing. Because at the time they were showing him, here are these UFOs coming in and out of our atmosphere with impunity. You know, what are you going to do about it? And I think that Reagan, I'm going to say this about President Reagan. I think that he was thinking he was the person, the great communicator, who could bring this across home plate in terms of how important this was. Now, I want to flash back to Jessup here for a moment and talk about some of the details of his death. Because this is going to be important for another aspect of this, which is the experimental technology and the rediscovery, the archaeological aspect of this. One of the things that happens is Jessup, after all this, you know, kind of controversy is created by the Vero edition, he's writing another book, and he gets very excited about the work, the breakthrough that he's made, and he calls up his friend Manson Valentine. Now, he says to him, I'm headed over to see you. I'm going to bring you some very fascinating research. You're not going to believe this. I can't talk about it on the phone. He's driving down. Finally, J. Manson Valentine is like, where is this guy? You know, he's a day late. And they will find him now in this Florida park. And he has rerouted the carbon monoxide through his rear window and killed himself in his car, supposedly. And that's the history. That's how they get rid of Jessup off the board through the Exprotect group. And Jessup was certainly one of the original missing or dead scientists in relation to this. He was eliminated by that group because he was the one, as I mentioned, who was really polished in bringing this forward and had that clout of being able to, you know, present UFOs to a public and really give it the credibility that it needed. He also was making these incredible discoveries. Now, J. Manson Valentine was a Yale oceanographer. What is he famous for? Well, he's famous for fulfilling the prediction of the prophet Edgar Cayce, who said, look, Atlantis is rising, and it's rising off the East Coast. As a matter of fact, Poseidia was the last major stronghold of Atlantis, and that is the group of islands there between Bimini, Cuba, and the Yucatan Peninsula. That whole piece, Casey's saying, look, land is rising and the temples are rising there that had this incredible Atlantean two-eye technology. And of course, if you get into any of this, whenever you get around that area, which we've referred to as the hot zone, we've done over 40 episodes of the hot zone material, often imitated, but never topped. One of the things I can say about this is there's incredible advanced technology associated with that area. And it has to do with the rediscovery of these Atlantean artifacts. But there's something about the magnetic currents down there that apparently the Atlanteans were taking advantage of as well. And of course, we have overlapping all of this, the Bermuda Triangle, mysterious disappearances, that same thing about green clouds showing up and planes or boats going right into those clouds and disappearing. Well, the original story of the Philadelphia experiment is that eerie kind of green fog that comes about as a result of the experiment, the electromagnetism field that's created, and the teleportation piece. It creates this separate field, generates an entirely different reality. I've called those effects the apotheme effect. The same thing happens, by the way, in this reality distortion field as when UFOs show up, and we've talked about missing time and things of that nature. The fundamental normal laws of physics that we understand cease to function, and we get this other thing, you know, where time disappears, and, you know, relatives and loved ones who have passed on appear out of nowhere, you know, when you approach a UFO or an entire city power grid goes down, you know. So there's a number of things here that I've talked about where craft land and then nothing will ever grow there again. You know, these are factors that are, you know, basically reality distortions. And part of that reality distortion is the effect that comes off these craft. So this is part of the secrecy and part of the things that have been hidden over time. It's amazing because when we brought forward the story just a few weeks ago now about this, and it's, you know, it's right in the heart of this episode, which is they are building the Golden Dome, the headquarters, right where the Philadelphia experiment took place. And yet you have that entire media field that follows the UFO file and, you know, the ones that are trying to get some leverage on this and figure out what the story is really about. And they don't really know much about it. They're doing a terrible job. The independent media is doing a terrible job. I don't know if they haven't studied the subject or if they're being manipulated, but, you know, you have them running around in this stupid fight between CIA counterintelligence agents, you know, and they're talking about Lou Elizondo, who has been proven over and over again to be an abject liar in relation to the UFO file. And he's not who he says he is at all. And he has, but he has gone on the record saying, I'm a counterintelligence guy and I want to destroy the UFO field. Well, you know, that's, he has come out and said that much. But I think what we get is, you know, they're setting up this clash between him and the guy I mentioned earlier, David Grush, who, by the way, I'd be much more in favor of than Lou Elizondo, except for the fact that when I talked to Grush, he said, well, you know, I can't go on your show because Chris Mellon, you know, basically calls the shots. And this is a big problem. And if Grush doesn't throw off Mellon, then he's completely unacceptable as this UFO, UAP czar, whatever it is. I do think this latest release, you know, the fifth release that they've done it now, there's a kind of public fatigue setting in also around it, which is, where is this going? You're showing us blips on a screen and, ooh, isn't that interesting and all the rest. Well, you have to understand they're doing the things in the background to set up the circumstances for the Golden Dome. The Golden Dome is kind of the, you know, creme de la creme here of setting up the UFO grid. And the ships that are being made by Hanwha right there in the naval shipyard where the Philadelphia experiment happened are being called Golden Defender. Well, we've gone into this blue UFO thing and the gold, the blue and the gold aspect being blended in here. Of course, blue and gold being germane to the Masonic lodges as well. You're going to have to understand if you're to get to the heart of this without too much imagery or superstition or biases, whatever it happens to be. But also, you need to understand if you're a serious researcher around the UFO file, you need to know the mystery school aspect and how it's just sitting there in the heart, in the middle of all this. And if you can get into some of the mystery elements that are going on, then it's going to take you to a much, you know, much further down the road in relationship to this. After all, you know, a lot of craft and a lot of advanced things were saved from our ancient past by these mystery school groups. If we get our heads wrapped around that, and also the fact that not everything that we're witnessing is necessarily physical, I think that's crucial realization as well. You do have them trying to compensate for this with, you know, silly stories about UFOs are demons. And you have the Vice President of the United States literally saying this, which is one of the most egregious, some of the dumbest statements by any vice president ever. You know, it's just some weird opinion of his that has nothing to do with any kind of research or science or anything he could bring before. It's just like, oh, yeah, I believe UFOs are demons. Well, that is setting up the threat and pandering to the Christian audience. And there's no question, in my opinion, that they're underestimating Christians there as well. But they're trying to create this thing where they say, hey, look, there's a threat. And you guys, we have this down. Just, you know, this is why all that money has disappeared out of the budget. You know, you've got this $50 trillion going out the back door. And when you think about these things, like, watch out, because they're telling you in so many words, this is what we're doing. We're setting up the story you're going to get that we've been fighting these demons in space, and, you know, the NRO and the NGA and the CIA and NSA, the reason they've lied to you so nakedly is because they had to fight off these evil astronauts and demons and all the rest of it. The UFO field is so rich. The stories are so rich. The interactions with beings, you know, the UFO abduction category is still very, very mysterious. There's a science aspect. There's a biological aspect. There's so many things there to discover. And for it all to be brought down to some horrible government level about a UFO threat, and to have CIA people being like, I'm the czar. No, I'm going to be czar. I mean, it's really that bad, you know. It's that ugly, I guess you might say. And what I've noticed, and I've interacted with some of those people, I've always invited those people onto the show as well. And they've always, you know, had to run a mile, because the problem is all you have to do is ask them straight questions. And if they lie on the record, as they have been lying, then, you know, kind of unravels their op. But they've gone with the real softball people on this. And a lot of those softball people, you know, I mentioned guys like Knapp and Dolan and others. You know, Knapp just had Bob Bigelow on, and Bob Bigelow's taken us all back to 1990s, and, you know, hey, there was a down craft, and there was a whistleblower who said something about a down craft. Look, that guy with his, you know, billionaire position there researching the UFO file with the gray head as his logo for his company, he knows a great deal about the UFO file. So does Elon Musk and others. And to sit there and pretend, you know, also be like, oh, I hope, you know, Mr. Bigelow, that we can have more conversations like this. Well, Knapp has known Bigelow for like 3 decades or something. Bigelow hired him. So he was like a paid consultant to Bigelow. You know, and there's been a story that's been circulating recently that Elizondo said that Knapp was his employee. So, you know, that UFO field has so many issues and problems. As I've mentioned before, the deep state researchers have such an advantage, and I wish that more of the deep state researchers would get involved with this, because the deep state people understand how the government operates, and that's how you can get groups like X Protect and all the rest of it. The UFO crowd just wants to go over a cliff with, you know, CIA people, and that has nothing to do with anything. It's all a circus. In fact, and the government aspect of the Trump administration doing these rolling releases of very limited content, which is obviously low quality gun camera footage and things of this nature, they have such high quality imagery and all sorts of things in relation to the UFO file that the things that they're releasing are, you know, it literally is no potency to any of it. It's not going to change anything. And they're just kind of odd anomalies that could be explained away as anything. They could be training tests for different types of technology that we have. They could be manipulations of gun camera footage, you know. So when you think about the trove of things that NASA has, and it's one of the reasons that Elon Musk wanted to get his friend Isaacman in there, then you start to get your head wrapped around the idea of exactly what they're doing with the UFO threat piece. You have to understand that when we're looking at this from the perspective of trying to unravel the UFO mystery, there's another group, this intelligence group, which is trying to whitewash the public about it. They denied it for 75 years. Now they're trying to co-opt it, whitewash it with their threat story so that they can institute a continuity of government program. And one of the things that I want to read here comes directly from the work of Professor Peter Dale Scott to understand this about continuity of government. This might wrap the whole thing quite well. But it's very interesting because the group continuity of government, we're still under that emergency. And one of the things that Professor Scott pointed out recently, and he's still writing now in his 90s, is that January 6th, they also activated continuity of government, and they had COG snipers ready to, you know, kind of switch this whole thing into COG. So you're always just a little bit, you know, away from COG being activated. And the continuity of government program, if you have that type of activation, you basically have one person who is in charge of NORAD. He's also in charge of NORTHCOM, which is an illegal group, military group that runs the United States. Who agreed to that? Well, apparently it was brought in after 9/11. And, you know, before we had things like SOUTHCOM and CENTCOM to run these various areas, but we didn't have military running us. You know, we had police running us. That's the posse comitatus from a long, long time ago. And so bringing in this aspect of the continuity of government program and how the continuity of government program people always seem to show up in these deep events in history, going all the way back to the Kennedy assassination through Watergate, Iran-Contra, and September 11th, you know, the financial coup, the COVID operation. There's all kinds of COG people involved here. And, you know, around some of the Trump assassination attempts there were as well. One of the things, and I do think it's very peculiar, that our friend Peter Dale Scott asked was, Trump obviously is aware that they try to use COG to remove him, you know, during that 2020 election. And now when you look at it, what's going on in relation to COG, he's signing on every year to that NDAA. Well, now they're tacking on all sorts of things to the NDAA. Nobody can seem to get out of this trap of signing it. And because you hold up over $1 trillion in military funding. So that military beast continues to grow, the authoritarianism, you know, the aggression, the wars of aggression, and these things are continuing. And then I'm taking it back now and saying, let's look at what they're doing with the UFO file, because they're making that. That's where you get terms like pursue, and that's where you get war.gov, you know, /UAP or whatever. You know, they're tying in that UFO thing with the war thing because they're planning to stage a group dealing with this that would be attacking, and that they are going to be able to announce emergency powers in relation to fighting off this threat. This is the crucial thing, I think, that needs to be eliminated. So when we reflect on the story of the Philadelphia experiment, when we look at the life of Morris Jessup and the things that were being discovered and coming up around this, and people like Allende giving us that deep information about the unified field information that Einstein had developed, this invisibility, as far long ago as 1928. When they did this experiment and they had these results, where did those projects go? That becomes a really central core question. The same year as the Tesla papers, John Trump's involvement, and this company now some 80 some odd years later, and what are they doing? They are setting up the entire Golden Dome headquarters right there where the USS Eldridge disappeared and was teleported to Norfolk, Virginia, all the way back in 1943. If you don't read that symbolism, if you don't see these things before they're incoming, if you keep getting caught up in the dribble around limited UFO releases, or, you know, Lou Elizondo, UAP czar, CIA man, or CIA releases around this, or the different people they roll out on the podcast, pop click shows, you're going to miss it. And you have to get with the vitality. Here are the two main stories of the UFO file for 2026 so far. The missing scientist story, the general is missing, the man in charge of the UFO file is missing. That's a national security crisis. One, two, the Golden Dome is headquartered where the original Philadelphia experiment teleportation invisibility took place. Those two things are, in fact, the biggest stories of the UFO file for 2026. And the dribs and drabs of the releases and all the rest of it, you know, it keeps the conversation going in the public, but that conversation can be turned and co-opted and astroturfed. So you don't want the CIA and the NRO and the NGA doing that, because it's going to lead into a very, very dark place. So we're going to be keeping a close eye on this and the developments of the Golden Dome. I want you all now to really, you know, lock into this idea of this story of this Korean, South Korean company setting up the Golden Dome right there, and what the Golden Dome is, what the cost of it will be, what it actually is versus what it's assumed to be, is something that can take out these hypersonic missiles. And do we need that? And what is going on here in relation to Trump, Trump's uncle, and all the rest of it? All that coming to the surface can provide us with a totally different picture on all of this. Of course, I want to remind you to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our free newsletter. That's a newsletter that keeps us in touch through the immense, really heavy-duty censorship that we've been seeing. And that censorship is there for a reason. They're trying to keep a lid on the information, but we can get around it all by getting you that information weekly, the interviews we have coming up for you, off the charts, episodes dealing with this, and also going deep, deep in the X-Series episodes and our docuseries, JFK and the UFO File and The Craze and the Hot Zone, Pyramid X and the Hunt for Atlantis. All of that is there in the newsletter. Stand up and be counted. Make sure it's there for you. So what we're going to do is, you know, we're going to continue to take a deep look at the Golden Dome in upcoming episodes. And I want you all to keep in mind that there's a massaging, there's a narrative building exercise that is taking place here. And the only way to get to the bottom of that is to see through it from the beginning. So here are some of the tools to do that. And part of that is in that little Philly shipyard where the Golden Dome headquarters is being set up. Remember the Greenland story? We're going to invade Greenland. yeah, well, maybe there's getting some idea of the reasons that they were planning to do these things. And Cuba, no question, the idea of an upcoming invasion of Cuba plays into this as well. So don't believe the hype, and definitely double check everything that comes out in relation to what they're saying about the UFO file. Now, never let it be forgot that once there was a Camelot, and we will see you all again very, very soon. Have a fantastic weekend.